I wanted to discuss karma this weekend because it's probably one of the most central teachings that the Buddha gave. And yet in modern Buddhism, people tend to see it as expendable. Who needs karma? We've got mindfulness. We've got compassion. We've got all kinds of these other things we like about Buddhism, but we don't like karma. A lot of this has to do with the fact that I think that the teaching is misunderstood. Again, this is common in a lot of modern Buddhism, misunderstanding things. Mindfulness, for example, is misunderstood, but it's really liked. It's become very popular. It's kind of like the science fiction story I read years back. These people were on a rocket that was surveying different planets, and the rocket had this sensor that could tell, as you approached a planet, you could tell whether the inhabitants were friendly or not. And if they were unfriendly, they would go away. But if they're friendly, they would land. And they came to this one planet that the friendliness rating was really, really high. And as they got closer and closer to the planet, you know, basically the gauges were pegging out. And they would land, and there's these places covered with these little cute little furry figures. And they all just seemed to be loving the people who were coming to visit. So they climb up the rocket. And so the astronauts say, okay, we'll open the doors. And they open the doors, the little furry creatures come in, eat them up. That's what's happened to mindfulness. It's been eaten up. Whereas karma is misunderstood and is disliked. Part of what people dislike about it is what they think it says. In other words, what they think the content of the teaching is. Primarily, they feel that it's deterministic. It's focused on the idea that you've got some bad karma and there's nothing you can do about it, and so you just got to suck it up. They feel basically that karma gives no room for free will. I've made a survey of different writings and Buddhist teachings on modern Buddhist teachings on karma, and some of the complaints about it include these ones: that it indulges in a childish need for a sense of fairness to the universe. That goes against the facts, and also extracts the sense of fairness at a price. On the one hand, they say it teaches a lack of compassion, that it justifies the status quo. If someone is suffering, then basically it's either karma and you become hard-hearted to them. Basically saying that people are suffering because they deserve to suffer, which is psychologically unhealthy because it victimizes the victim. Also induces complacency in people whose lives are going well. I must have done something right, so I deserve this happiness that I've got. Another complaint that I see is that it doesn't fit in with a more New Age idea of reality being totally pliable, that you can create any reality you want. If you've got some past karma coming in from the back, that would get in the way of your creating the reality you want. This is what I call the Barney the Dinosaur philosophy. I guess you do have Barney the Dinosaur in Canada. Yeah. All you have to do is think it, and it's going to come true, that attitude. Another complaint is that it doesn't fit into the context of not-self, when that teaching on not-self is seen as the idea of no self or no separate self. If there's no self, who does the action and who receives the result? Karma doesn't make sense in that context. If there's no separate self, we can only have collective karma. I mean, individuals are not really responsible for the individual decisions. There's kind of a collective karma, and it's that collective karma that we can focus on. But the idea of individual karma, these writers say, is doesn't fit in with the idea of there being no separate self. Finally, some people complain that the teaching is immature and irresponsible, and it focuses on your intentions to the exclusion of the result, i.e. when the Buddha said karma is intention, these people understand this meaning all you have to do is have is good intentions and everything works out. This criticism is that, okay, you have to look at the results as well, and for some reason they think Buddhists ignore the results. All of this is based on a misunderstanding, which we'll find in the course of the weekend. A second reason for disliking the teaching is that what might be called the application and the part of life that it pertains to. It seems to focus attention more on the past and on the future and not on the present moment. In other words, people think about their past karma or the future results of their karma and don't seem to be focusing on the present moment. Now, some of these misunderstandings come with the fact that we tend to confuse Buddhist notions of karma with other karma doctrines that came from India at pretty much the same time. We think that everybody in India believed the same karma doctrine, and the Buddha simply picked up those beliefs without really thinking about them. It's like saying that Plato taught ethics and Aristotle taught ethics, and so they must be the same because it's the same word. You know? Sometimes these misunderstandings come from actually well-meaning Buddhists themselves who have a very simplistic interpretation of karma that does make it sound deterministic. And some of the complaints simply come from an antipathy to things like rules and precepts and shoulds. I was sitting in a course one time years back when a teacher was explaining the Metta Sutta, and it starts out with the first line, this is what should be done by someone who aims at a state of peace. Someone in the room raised his hand and said, I thought Buddhism didn't have shoulds. And the poor teacher spent the whole morning talking about what kind of shoulds Buddhism has. So given that people don't like karma, they try to replace it with a more general principle of interconnectedness. The teaching on dependent core arising is interpreted as kind of a general principle that everything in the world is interconnected. And then this becomes pressed into the service to provide the basis for a Buddhist ethics, that you develop a sense of the fact that we are all interconnected, and that should make you spontaneously behave in a way that is responsible and helpful for all beings. Do's and don'ts become based less on specific rules and more of a sense on your sense of oneness, trusting your feelings and not, of course, not wanting to be bound by rules. I often get a question when we discuss karma in other places, that why is this focused on minutiae of actions, not just open to the open oneness that is just already there around us, waiting for us to kind of open up to it? And the Buddhist answer is that the oneness around us is a fabrication. It's something that's put together through your intentions and through your perceptions. And if it's not informed by right view, it's actually not part of the path. If it is informed by right view, then you realize, well, this is just a state of concentration. It's not the goal. And because it is fabricated, you can't trust it. It also turns out that we can't get to the ultimate goal of freedom without pursuing our freedom of choice in the present moment. That's where we're going to find this potential for freedom, by getting closer and closer to our choices we're making in the present moment as we get more and more sensitive to them. It's there that the deathless can be found, not just by having a perception of oneness or a perception of kind of the space that surrounds you and hoping to rest in that. The other problem with this complaint is that interconnectedness is presented as a state that we want to maintain. There's no idea of wanting to get out of the interconnected world. I'm just going to stay here. In fact, sometimes you probably hear the concept that our being is interbeing, that we inter-are, in which case we wouldn't be able to get out. As one Chinese philosopher once said, nobody's going to get enlightened until even the least blade of grass is going to get enlightened. Nobody's getting out at all. So I'd like to look at the facts on the Buddhist teachings, what he actually says about this, both on karma and on dependent core arising, to see actually the two are interrelated, but they teach an ethics that's not based on just kind of a sense of interconnectedness, but they show about how your choices actually make a difference, and you have to be very careful about it. We'll be focusing on karma this morning, and unfortunately we'll be focusing on dependent core arising this afternoon. I say unfortunately because you will have eaten. And that's not the state of mind to approach dependent core arising with. But the topic worked out that way, so I'm sorry. So for lunch, try not to eat too much. So the first set of readings, and I'd like to give a little talk first before we approach the readings. And before I do that, I'd like to stop and ask you any questions on what I've said so far. Okay, let's go. Okay, why did the Buddha teach karma? His own quest for a true happiness began with the observation that people can develop skills. We have this ability. And his question was, is there a skill that can put an end to suffering? After he found that there was such a skill, he had to formulate a teaching on action that would make the case that such a skill was possible. Because it turns out in India at his time, it's not that everybody believed in karma or rebirth. there was a lot of discussion about this, people saying that there is no such thing as action, your actions are illusory, or if there are actions, you don't have any choice, or even if you have a choice, they don't have any results. So we had to present a case, what is actually happening when you act, and what is the nature of reality such that the developing of a skill to put an end of suffering actually makes sense. So karma has to be essential to a teaching. It is a path of action that he's teaching, so the Buddha had to explain, well, what is action? How does it work? Furthermore, he had to explain a difficult issue, which is why it is that a path of action would lead to something that he said is unmade. In Pali, the word for to make and to act are the same words. And so if you're doing something, how can your actions lead to something that is not done? And this is an issue that he was going to have to address. But first, let's look at the psychological issues. As I said earlier, a lot of people say that the teaching on karma is psychologically unhealthy. And I'd like to clear that issue out of the way to begin with. You ask yourself, suppose you have a child, and you're teaching a skill to the child, and you want the child to have a healthy attitude toward action in general. What are the attitudes you would like the child to develop? What you would teach the child? The first thing you would probably teach the child is, one, think before you act. Don't just act on your impulse. Choose carefully what you want to do, because your actions are going to have results. You hit your baby sister, and she's going to hit back. You break your toy, and that's the only toy you've got because mom and dad aren't wealthy. Okay, that kind of thing. So think before you act. This is basically when you're teaching the principle of heedfulness, i.e. you have to be careful about your actions because they can have some unfortunate consequences if you're not. Second thing you'd want to teach the child is that your intentions really do make a difference. Your punishment for the child for intending to hit the sister is going to be very different from accidentally hitting the sister. However, good intentions are not enough. You've actually got to look at, well, when you do something, what are the results going to be? The child decides it's going to help mommy by fixing some food tonight, and the child doesn't know what he's doing. You can create a fire in the kitchen and make a huge mess one way or the other. So you ask, okay, just because you have good intentions, it's not enough. You have to think carefully around that. If you see that you are actually doing something hurtful, stop. This is the principle of compassion. You don't want to hurt people. If you've seen that you have done something harmful, tell it to mom and dad. Don't be ashamed to tell. This is an important principle. The kid has to own up to its actions. This, of course, requires that mom and dad be mature as well. The kid comes in and says, I broke your binoculars. You don't go off the handle. You figure out some way to sit the child down, and you take a couple of deep breaths, and you talk to the child about being careful about mommy and daddy's things. At the same time, if you have done something harmful, resolve not to repeat the mistake. This gives you a healthy sense of what would be called a healthy sense of shame. The idea of shame has gotten a lot of bad press in the West, but actually shame, a healthy sense of shame is the sense that, okay, certain action is beneath me. I'm a better person than that. I shouldn't be doing that kind of thing. And for a child, this means, okay, now you're 4 years old, you don't do your two-year-old kind of things anymore. You're growing up. And in asking the child to admit its mistakes, you're teaching the child to have remorse, but don't be debilitated by it. Actually, regret the mistake. At the same time, don't be callous. Don't say, well, it doesn't really matter. In this case, you're teaching the child honesty and integrity. And finally, learn from your mistakes so that you don't have to repeat them. This is how you teach the child to look not only at the intentions again, but also at the results of the intentions. And I've learned, looking around, that we can see the need for these attitudes. When you look at the way modern culture tends not to foster them. I was giving a retreat a couple of years ago to a group of Dharma punks, and there's this one woman who was saying, well, with my daughter, I basically don't tell her no unless she's doing something that could physically harm her. And then she said, but I've noticed my daughter has trouble getting along with the other kids. So You have to. It's part of the parent's responsibility for the child's well-being to teach the child. Okay, certain things are just not done, and you have to be able to say no. But you say no in a way that the child learns from it. When we look at how the Buddha taught karma to his son, and that's what the first reading is about, basically, the conversation between Buddha and Rahula, he's teaching the same principles. According to the commentary, Rahula was 7 years old when the Buddha gave these teachings. And you look at them and you see the Buddha starts out. Okay, one thing that's not listed there that should have been is the Buddha, before he gives this conversation, he basically teaches Rahula the importance of being truthful. You get the feeling that Rahula probably told a lie that day. And so the Buddha comes in. Rahula sees him coming from afar. He sets out some water for him, a little water dipper to wash his feet. So the Buddha comes, washes his feet, and he leaves a little bit of water in the dipper. He says, Rahula, do you see this little tiny bit of water left in the dipper? And Rahula says, yes. He says, that's how much goodness there is in a person who tells a deliberate lie and doesn't feel any sense of shame. Then he takes the water and he throws it away. He says, see how that water's been thrown away? Rahula says, yes. That's what happens to the goodness of someone who tells a deliberate lie without a sense of shame. It gets thrown away. Rahula's getting the message. Do you see how empty this dipper is? Yes, 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 yes. So we've established the principle that you got to be truthful, and it means being both truthful to yourself as well as truthful to other people. Then he gives this teaching on reflecting on your actions. And it boils down to this. Before you act, ask yourself, what consequences do you anticipate? Okay, think before you act. If you see that it's going to cause any harm, don't do it, i.e. compassion. If you don't foresee any harm, go ahead and do it. But if you see anything harmful coming up while you're doing it, stop. You're not committed to doing it. If you don't see anything harmful coming up, continue with the action. At the end of the action, look at the long-term consequences. If you see that there were good long-term consequences, take joy in that fact that you're training, doing well in the training. If you see there are any unfortunate consequences, go and talk it over with somebody who's also on the path, someone who's more advanced than you are. Get advice from that person, and then resolve not to repeat that mistake again. So it's basically what we identified as the healthy attitudes that you want to have around action. You want to have compassion, you want to be heedful, you want to have some honesty and integrity around your actions. And so these psychological attitudes, they qualify as what we would say is healthy. But we have to think about, what are some of the metaphysical assumptions underlying these teachings? Sometimes you hear that the Buddha did not teach metaphysics, but he avoided metaphysical issues that had nothing to do with whether there's an end of suffering. But the things that actually were relevant, he would teach. First one is that you do have free will. As he said, if you can't assume free will, then teaching a path to the end of suffering makes no sense. Why would you teach a path? People can't choose it. Either they're going to do it or they're not going to do it, but they don't have any choice. So you have to have free will to choose what to do and what not to do. Secondly, you are responsible for your actions. It's not some God acting through you or some cosmic force acting through you. Years back, I read a piece in Inquiring Mind about a woman who was meditating at a meditation center back east. And she was suddenly discovered she's had a lot of lust for this young man sitting in front of her. And it got so bad that she had to leave the room and go back and meditate in her bedroom. And then she got back to the bedroom. She said that she realized it wasn't her own personal lust. It was the cosmic force of lust acting through her. And, I don't think so. So the assumption the Buddha has you act on is you are responsible for your actions. Okay. Third one is that your actions really do have results and they can be beneficial or harmful. You are an agent, therefore, in shaping your own happiness and sadness and pain. Those results do follow a pattern. Otherwise, you could not learn anything from your past mistakes. If gravity pulled things down today and pulled things up tomorrow, this would be a very difficult world to live in. But there are certain patterns that you can learn so that you can anticipate the results and learn from your past mistakes so you can apply the knowledge to the future. The problem is sometimes the pattern is so large that you need the help of others in order to see it properly. Like you made a mistake, you're talking to someone else, this person has more experience than you do, and they say, well, actually, the situation is more like this, because they've had more experience, they've had a longer time to look at things. Our intentions do make a difference, but good intentions on their own are not enough to make an action good. You also have to judge actions by their results. And this leads to the principle that the best intentions are more than just good, they're also skillful. In other words, that they take into consideration what actually happens in the world, and you take that knowledge and apply it as well. In terms of the Buddhist vocabulary, this means that they have to be not only freed of greed and aversion, but they also have to be free of delusion. And finally, the Buddha says that one of the implications here is knowledge is actually worthwhile. It makes a difference in our actions. Our actions make a difference in our experience of pleasure or pain. So learning about a path is something that makes sense, because it's going to have a difference in your actions, and then those actions will have a difference in your life. So what kind of metaphysics of actions is required here? There have to be patterns of cause and effect in the world. But causes from the past cannot entirely shape the present moment. There has to be room for a present choice to make a difference. In other words, what you've got from coming from the past will have to be potentials and not just a determined outcome. So you're dealing with many different potentials at any moment. This means that causality has to be complex, with your experience shaped both by present and past forces. Another point is that experience is not shaped entirely by physical or other outside forces. Mental forces have to play a role. In other words, the Buddha is not a materialist. That your mind has a role in shaping things, and your decisions are not determined by the atoms in your nerves, but they are actually determined by choices that you make as a conscious being. So the mind has to be an active principle so that there's free will in the present. So that's the kind of metaphysics that's going to be required. It's a metaphysics where you have a complex pattern and the mind is playing a major role in that pattern. Okay. Some of the practical implications here are, one, you can learn from others, but you also have to choose carefully who you learn from. The reason you need to learn from them is they have learned larger patterns of cause and effect that you haven't yet perceived. And they can help you imagine alternatives that you courses of action that you might have not have imagined before. And they can also help you understand what sorts of actions may be harmful even though they don't appear so, and others that are not harmful even though they may cause pain to oneself and others. In other words, there's going to be part of the path that's going to be painful. And when we talk about harming other people, it doesn't mean hurting their feelings. That's an important distinction. To harm somebody else is actually to get them to do something harmful. That's going to be bad karma for them. Another set of practical implications is the qualities you're going to need to engage in this practice. The first one is what the Buddha calls appropriate attention. Notice the Buddha never talks about bare attention in any of his teachings. It's always appropriate attention. In other words, for him, attention means what questions do you focus your attention on that you're going to try to answer. And in this case, in Rahula's case, the question is, what do I expect the actions, what kind of results do I expect from my actions? What results am I getting from the actions now in the present moment? What actions am I going to get over in the long term? Those are the appropriate questions to ask. Specifically because you're looking at things with the intention of alleviating harm. Another quality that's required is ardency. You have to put in effort to carry through with this program. It requires alertness, paying attention to your intentions and actions while they're happening, and noting the results that come in the present moment. And finally, it requires mindfulness, your ability to keep lessons from the past in mind. Now, ardent, alert, mindful, these are the qualities that go into a mindfulness practice. So given the nature of action, this is why we need these qualities. You're going to be learning from the past. You have to notice what you're actually doing in the present moment, and you have to have the sense of ardency so that you learn how to do it well. you go back and you look in the teachings on mindfulness and the formula for mindfulness, and those are the qualities that the Buddha says you've got to bring to the practice. So these teachings to Rahula have metaphysical applications, and they also have implications, and they also have practical implications. We'll be getting into both in the course of the weekend. But right there, I'd like to stop and ask if there are any questions. Glasses on so I can see. Yes. Planting a harmful idea on them, like saying that just war. You know, there are times when it's a good thing to go out and kill people. That kind of thing. Yes. Hit you. Okay. Well, it's married life and. Again, you have to ask yourself, because some people get their feelings hurt over things that are totally irrational. You can't be responsible for that. I mean, if you're actually trying to make them upset with no good purpose at all, okay, that would be unskillful. But there are times when you say, okay, this is the right thing to do, and you may not agree, but this is what's got to be done. You can't let other people's feelings, you know, run your life. You have to look back again at your intentions. What is my intention here? If the hurt feelings are a consequence of my doing something that I know is otherwise right, you try to smooth the other person's feathers as much as you can. But some people just, you know, ruffle their feathers all the time. So you can't let that control your life. Teresa, you look concerned. And so, as I said, you try to smooth things over. This is one of the lessons I learned in Thailand. You don't create controversy unless you really have to. And you do your best to smooth people's feelings. I had a lesson one time. There was an older monk who was staying at the monastery. He'd ordained late in life. And he spent all of his time listening to the radio in the afternoon. I was not impressed with the guy. And one morning he was claiming that he'd gone beyond sensual desire a long time ago. But I began to notice that when every time there seemed to be even the slightest opportunity to talk about going out, his old days of going out looking for women in the evening, that kind of stuff, he talked about it quite actively. And he was the only monk in the whole monastery who was talking about this topic. And so one morning he talks about how he was beyond his sensual desire, and I turned him and said, look, you're the only one around here who's talking about this kind of stuff. Well, there was a big explosion. And word got to my teacher, who hadn't been there that morning. And he said, you know, the next time that issue comes up, say, look, you may be on sensual desire, but the rest of us are not. And so when you talk about these things, it really disturbs us. So years later, when I was in charge of the monastery, there was this young monk whose mother would bring the Tairat, which is one of the, it's not a Playboy, it's a Tairat, it's more like, what's a cheap newspaper in Canada? The kind of a tabloid kind of newspaper. And it has two sections, and always on the front page of section two would be this scantily clad woman, you know.
Vancouver Sun.
Vancouver Sun, okay. And it so happened, it seemed that every time these newspapers were left scattered around, it was always page one of section two. You know? And so I called the monks together and I said, look, this may not be having an effect on you, but it's having an effect on me. Okay, I'd rather you not do this. That was it. That was the end of the problem. Both. Well, confession is basically admitting that you've done something wrong, which can be the beginning, say, of a reconciliation, or just opening up to somebody else and saying that, okay, I want you to know so that I'm not hiding things from you. And then the making amends is, from the Buddhist point of view, it's basically saying making amends is resolving not to repeat the mistake in the future, which is the second step of reconciliation. In this case, it might be saying, look, I did this, and I realize it was wrong, and I'm going to do my best not to do it again in the future. And then any extra making amends you want to, that's not necessarily Buddhist, but it may be, you know, take them out for dinner, do something like that. That's not the Buddhist approach, but that's basic common sense, you know. But from the Buddhist point of view, it's the resolve, it's the basically promise not to repeat the mistake. Okay, so if you run into somebody's car, you do something, you know, for them. But for the monks, it's interesting that for a monk, that's what's asked of the monk, is he, okay, I admit my mistake and I will promise not to do it again. Because monks don't have the wherewithal to go out and buy insurance and things to pay for other people's cars, which is one of the reasons why we don't drive. Okay.
No, not necessarily.
Knowledgeable person, yeah. Because someone who can actually give you wise advice on how to handle the situation. Yes. Okay, what kind of harm would you be causing?
For example, say someone is sufficiently paranoid that they say they are acting in a way of violence.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And they, in fact, will do that.
Calling the police is not doing them harm.
Well, it's unknown.
Right. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You take the action. I mean, your intention is not to get that person to go out and shoot somebody else or whatever. Your intention is basically protect yourself. And by bringing in the police, that might actually prevent the person from going out and shooting somebody else. So I wouldn't call that causing harm. Could you give an example?
Consciously, I gave someone the wrong hotel to go visit a mutual friend.
Mm-hmm.
But unconsciously, there was probably an intention through a feeling of neediness or jealousy.
Mm-hmm.
Types of
Yeah. One is you don't give misinformation. And then secondly, you have to ask, well, what is my motivation here? And this is a motivation that I would be, would I feel okay about telling to somebody else? I mean, this is one of the things about this process of confessing mistakes to somebody else. You say, gosh, if I'd be embarrassed to tell that to anybody else, I better not do it. You know? Mm-hmm. And then the part of you that says, well, wait a minute, I don't want this to happen. He says, okay, look at that. Why give into that? Well, one, it's not just in the West that you get a wide variety of teachers. And I think in Asia there are just as many, just as wide a variety. Secondly, over there, though, they don't call Buddhist groups sanghas. This is a real difference, because when you think about taking refuge in the sangha, you're not taking refuge in the Victoria Insight Meditation Society. Okay. Even though they're a nice society, but still, it's not a sangha. You know, traditionally, the sangha was the sangha of monastics. That was the sangha that you took refuge in. Now, they have another word for Buddhist groups, which is bardhisa, which is a perfectly fine word. It'd be nice to import that, because you have lay bardhisas and you have monastic bardhisas. Any group would be a bardhisa. But in terms of the sharing and the not sharing, I mean, that's really an individual basis kind of thing. Because even in Asia, you have some groups that will be really into sharing meditation experiences, and other groups will say, well, let's just get together and meditate quietly, because we all have wrong view, and if we open up about our wrong views, we'll just multiply wrong views. As Western, as you think about enlightened people, those are the people you can take refuge in. That's your refuge. Exactly. They're directly connected. Because the right questions basically have to do with where is the suffering, what's causing it. Those are the right questions. Other right questions are what's skillful, what's not skillful. Or in the case of what the Buddha taught Rahula here, because look at my actions. Is this going to be a skillful action, or is this not going to be a skillful action? Those are the. You have to recognize, you know, that whether you're a bad person or a good person is one of the questions the Buddha has you put aside. The question is, what did I do? Was it right? Was it wrong? Can I learn from that? I mean, that's the best thing you could ask from a human being, is the ability to admit mistakes and learn from mistakes. Notice the Buddha is saying you try not to make mistakes, but he's not saying never make a mistake. He's saying, okay, if you make mistakes, this is what you do. He's giving you a process for dealing with it. And the sense of shame there, as I said earlier, is all these sense of shame, that's actually connected with a sense of self-esteem. Okay, I'm a better person than that. I shouldn't go back to doing that again. And so it's not the kind of debilitating shame that just pulls you down. It's the sense of shame that a person has a strong sense of honor. And the worth of it, and they want to be a reliable person. So I'm ashamed that I did that, so I'm not going to do it again. That way you maintain your honor without losing it. Yes.
In reading
that's actually tomorrow morning's topic, but we can do it now. It's an ornament of the mind. It just becomes a natural expression of the mind at that point. It's not that you're trying to get anything out of it. And it's just this, you see something and boom, you automatically say, this is what should be given there. It becomes kind of a natural, spontaneous generosity. Okay, let's look at the readings. Okay, well, this first passage here is with Rahula, which is what I just went over. You notice there's a slight difference here between the how you respond to the results of your bodily and verbal actions on the one hand and your mental actions on the other. In terms of bodily or verbal actions, those are the ones you talk over with somebody else if you've made a mistake. As for mental actions, he says you just reflect on it and you resolve not to repeat the mistake. In other words, you don't have to tell everybody about all the bad thoughts that went through your mind. You know? We wouldn't be able to do anything. What's interesting here is this pattern that the Buddha teaches to Rahula is a pattern that he uses again and again and again on more and more and more advanced levels of the practice. There's a sutta on emptiness, Majjhima 121, where the Buddha is talking about emptiness. In his sense, emptiness is not empty of inherent existence, which is the Mahayana emptiness. He's talking about creating a state of mind that is empty of distraction, empty of disturbance. And so you notice, okay, when you're meditating, is my mind empty of distraction? And to what extent is there, disturbance? To what extent is there still disturbance there? And so as your mind gets more and more concentrated, the first thing you do is you learn to appreciate, oh, my mind is a lot better shape now because it's less disturbed. That's how you learn how to read your mind. And then you look for, okay, what disturbance is still there? Well, let's do something about what am I doing that's contributing to the disturbance? Now, you realize this is the same pattern that he's using with Rahula. You look at the actions, you look at your results, and in this case it would be the state of your mind, and you appreciate the times when you are doing it well, and you appreciate, and then you look for the areas, okay, where am I still making a mistake? Let's get more and more precise about this. So this self-reflection here is a process that goes throughout the practice. You learn how to look at what you're doing, look at the results. And this is a path. This is a path that has a goal, and it also has good meditation sessions and bad meditation sessions. You probably heard, there is no such thing as a good meditation or bad meditation. Well, that's not true. If you're on a weekend retreat and you had the choice either of coming to the retreat or going down to the Caribbean, you probably say, "Okay, I want something out of this retreat," and because otherwise, I could have had at least a Caribbean experience. That's putting a lot of pressure on yourself, so this is why the teachers on short-term retreats will tend to say, there's no goal here, there's nothing to attain, because otherwise you're going to put yourself in a pressure cooker. By Monday, I want the first jhana, or that kind of thing, which is not helpful. And so they tell you not to judge your meditation and that kind of stuff, but if you're going to look at meditation as a lifetime experience, you want to learn how to judge. Did I do it well? Did I not do it well? If it didn't go well, what could I change? You keep reflecting on that again and again. Are there any questions on passage one? Yes.
I was struck when I was reading it about the strength of the intensity of the description. After performing a mental action that was unskilled, you should feel horrified, humiliated,
and disgusted. It's a pretty strong. The words are pretty strong in the Pali.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the second question is, understanding that the Western mind has this tendency for the Brock was talking about, self-blame, self-hatred, essentially, in the first one. How can we read that sentence and not fall into that kind of
trap? Okay, there's another passage where the Buddha uses the same set of terms when you're dealing with, when you realize that you've been involved in is sitting and meditating, and all of a sudden you find yourself in a pattern of thinking which is not going to be helpful. And the analogy he gives is someone who is a good-looking young person, fond of adornment, looks in the mirror and sees a dead snake wrapped around his or head, his or her neck. Now, the good-looking young person still realizes, okay, I look good, but the snake doesn't look good on me. You know? It makes the distinction. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you maintain your self-respect by saying, look, this is beneath me. I'm better than that. That's why I say this healthy sense of shame is paired with a sense of high self-esteem, basically. I wouldn't be sad doing this, right? Mm-hmm. 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 Anything else? Okay, passage 2. This is the Buddha basically saying that we do have the choice of abandoning what is unskillful and developing what is skillful. It's kind of an assertion of the principle of free will. I'm losing my notes here. And also, this is the Buddha's own statement of, if it weren't possible to do this, I wouldn't teach this to you. This is something that human beings can do, and it's worthwhile devoting your energies to this. Passage 3 is one of the two passages in the canon where the Buddha says his teachings are, the teaching in the passage is what he calls categorical. In other words, it's true across the board. The other categorical teaching is the Four Noble Truths. And this one is, okay, I say categorically that bodily misconduct, verbal misconduct, and mental misconduct should not be done. Then he goes down and gives his reasons for why you should not do this sort of thing. These are the drawbacks. You can fault yourself. Observant people on close examination can criticize you. Your bad reputation gets spread around. You die confused. And in the breakup of the body, after death, you reappear in a plane of deprivation, a bad destination, a lower realm in hell. Doesn't sound good. This business about dying confused, I know a member of my family had committed adultery, and as he was getting close to death, he was, you know, as one of my brothers said, he was expecting to see his wife on the other side with her frying pan raised in her. And so, you know, you look back on your life and you look at things you did and you look at the future and there doesn't seem to be much good. And that's one of the reasons why people tend to get really pretty delirious if they have a lot of misbehavior in their background. Then the Buddha goes on to say that he says categorically that good bodily conduct, good verbal conduct, and good mental conduct should be done. We're going to be getting the definitions of these in passage 4. And so the rewards are you don't fault yourself, observant people on close examination praise you, your good reputation gets spread about, you die unconfused, and on the breakup of the body after death you reappear in a good destination. It's interesting to note that the Buddha's two categorical teachings, i.e. the Four Noble Truths and this one on skillful actions, both contain duties. He just doesn't say there are such things as unskillful actions. He says they shouldn't be done. Skillful actions should be done. As with the Four Noble Truths, the truth of stress or suffering is something that should be comprehended. The cause of suffering should be abandoned. The cessation of suffering should be realized and the path should be developed. So the Buddha's teachings, these are his, you know, sort of bedrock teachings. They don't just stop with a statement of facts, they also state duties. And the duty here is not something the Buddha is imposing on you. He's saying, this is just the nature of things. If you want to put an end to suffering, this is what you got to do. And so that's this is another reason why the teachings on karma are so central to his teaching, because even his most basic teachings have an implied should. There's an activity that should be followed. One thing I wasn't able to include in this was there's a whole question when you're doing mindfulness practice. I mentioned earlier those qualities of alertness, ardency, and mindfulness. There's a controversy within the Theravada tradition of which of those qualities is the wisdom faculty in mindfulness. And most in the kind of mindfulness teachings that we're most familiar with here, they talk about alertness as being the wisdom faculty. It's usually translated as clear comprehension, and they talk about various ways in which that is wise. In the forest tradition, it's the ardency which is the wisdom faculty. In other words, you realize that, okay, this is the way things are. The wise thing will be to act in a certain way. And you learn from acting in that particular way that your knowledge of what's skillful and what's not skillful gets developed by putting it, what you know into practice. So again, it's the desire to do well, which is where the wisdom lies, again, which underlies the importance of this is all a path of action. Any questions on that? Right. There's a desire, yeah. This is where desire comes in as a healthy part of the practice. We have that common belief that the Buddha said all desire is bad. But he never says that. He only says three kinds of desire are bad. Sensual craving, craving to become, and craving to destroy yourself. Those are three kinds of... Now, become is the technical term there that's most difficult to get your head around, but I'll give you an example. Becoming is basically taking on an identity in a particular world of experience. And becoming can happen on many levels, like the fact that you have become a human being in this particular world of experience. So that's one level of becoming. But there's lots of psychological becoming that's going on all the time. Last night we talked about someone with a desire for cheesecake. Because becoming happens around desires. And you desire the cheesecake, and then the question is, okay, do I have the money to buy the cheesecake? And you check around in your pocket, I've got the money. How can I get out of here? Can I slip out the side when nobody's noticing so I can get the cheesecake? Where is the cheesecake available? That becomes the relevant part of your world. So that's the world that you're really in at that particular moment when the cheesecake desire kicks in. Okay, once the cheesecake desire has been satisfied, you say, okay, enough of cheesecake, what else? What else is there? And you can think of something else you want to do, and then you take on an identity around that. And again, a particular world of your experience is going to change. At that point, the cheesecake store is irrelevant. Suppose you decide you want to learn something. Okay, now I want to go to the library, or I want to go online. And that becomes the relevant part of your world. So this is called becoming. And the Buddha says, each time we take on a type of becoming like this, there's going to be suffering. But it turns out that concentration is also a kind of becoming. So you've got to take on some kinds of becoming as part of the path, so you can let go of other kinds of becoming. So those are the types of desire the Buddha said are going to cause suffering. Now the types of desire that are part of the path are the desire to be skillful, the desire to abandon what is unskillful. This all comes under right effort. The word in Pali is chanda. Sometimes in the old days they used to translate that as zeal because they were afraid to use the word desire. But that's actually what the word means in Pali is desire. And ardency basically is another expression of that. When I was in France 2 months ago, the question came up of how to translate that word into French. And there's a lot of discussion, and we finally came down to being basically wholeheartedly putting your whole heart into it. Tout le cœur.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You are on fire with the desire to do this well. Yes.
Mm-hmm. But no, there's a weird or anything not. There's all the precepts that can be wrong. Is that wrong? prisoner saying, I'm not going to do that again, is that sufficient? I mean, what happens?
Okay, you have to decide, okay, are you really serious about not doing it again, or are you just telling yourself that to make yourself feel good right now?
Well, I say sometimes I'm not going to do that again, but I do.
Okay. Now, the Buddha says...
I'm not going to do it again. Right?
Yeah, okay. This is when you need to up the ante. Okay, when you say you're not going to do it again, the Buddha, we'll be getting into this later, but one of the readings where the Buddha says, if you realize you've broken a precept, you think about, okay, what are the bad consequences of doing this? And not just because I broke a precept and I'm a bad little girl. It's okay, if I spend all my time yakking, think of all the time that's being wasted. Think of all the time that's being wasted. If you know somebody who's really good at electronics, get them to do a yakety yak app. And then at the end of the day, you can see, oh my gosh, I wasted. Right? Yeah, that's it. It adds up, you know. Well, fortunately, 12 minutes of yakety yak does not translate into 12 minutes of being yakety yaked too, you know. Yeah, you could. There is your problem. You've got to think about it. It's not only wasting my time, I'm wasting other people's time. You know? Now think about it, because there really are drawbacks to this. If I'm going to sit down and meditate, what kind of mind am I bringing to the meditation? You're bringing a yakety-yak mind, you know. And so that's when you say, if I really had goodwill for myself, I wouldn't be doing this. It has to be that part of the equation. Because part of you says, hey, I get pleasure out of what's wrong, you know. And the other, you have to have another part that says, look, okay, this pleasure is being bought at the price of something that would be better. This is why when the Buddha says you reflect on your past mistakes, the first thing you do is spread goodwill to yourself and to all the other people that you've harmed or could potentially harm. So think of the people you tend to yakety-yak to. Spread lots of goodwill to them. As if I really were concerned about their well-being, would I fill up their mental space with my yaks? You say, I just got to live with those. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've got to live with those. They're going to come. But fortunately, the Buddha says, you know, the results of past karma coming back to you are alleviated if you develop the right mind state.
Don't worry about the
tails. The yakety yak pit. Okay, well, the Buddha says there are only very few actions that will guarantee hell, okay? One is killing an arahant. Have you killed an arahant?
No,
not that you can remember, okay? Killing your parents? You haven't killed your parents? No, okay. Splitting the Sangha? And we're not talking about, you know, Victoria Insight Meditation Society. We're talking about, you know. You haven't called the Buddha, caused the Buddha to bleed? Have you caused the Buddha to bleed? No. No. Okay. Okay. Hell is not guaranteed for you. Okay. Okay.
Okay.
Well, it says, as you get into the deeper text, you realize the Buddha is talking about tendencies. There is a tendency of this kind of action to pull you down. Yeah, but if you also develop other actions in another direction, they will tend you in the other direction. Yeah. So you're tending more to the right, and we'll be getting into the qualities of mind that you want to develop in the present moment so that when the impact of past bad actions come to you, it's not going to be as heavy. And the short answer is develop as much unlimited goodwill and compassion and empathetic joy and equanimity. And also train your mind so that when pains come in, you're not overcome by the pain. When pleasures come, you're not overcome by the pleasure. Those are the two areas that you want to focus on. Yeah, just learn not to be overcome by it. You say, okay, I can sit with this for a while and it'll subside. I'm not afraid of it. Mm-hmm. That's what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Sensual. Yeah. Oh my gosh, I've never heard of yes, but that's pretty scary. Sensual desire. the one that everybody wants. That's the one that's not good. Sensual desire is pretty central. Sensual, okay. And that's not so much the desire for pleasant things, it's the desire to just keep thinking sensual thoughts. The Buddha makes the distinction there that even after awakening, people will still notice that something is pleasant or unpleasant, and that's not a problem for them. It's the real problem for us is that we tend to fantasize so much about sensual pleasures. You can have a pizza that will take 15 minutes to eat, but you can fantasize about it beforehand for a couple hours. And then afterwards, you can talk about what a great pizza it was and how we want more pizza from that same place the next day. That's the kind of thing the Buddha's talking about. Well, eventually there's going to be some suffering around that, but the Buddha says, okay, if it's a skillful desire for becoming, you actually encourage it as part of the path to begin with. There will come a point where you have to get beyond it. But again, like with the state of concentration, is also a kind of becoming. You want to become a good meditator, and he encourages that you think in that direction. But realizing that even the good things we do, there's going to be some suffering down the line. But the desire to become doesn't really leave until total awakening. Yes. Well, the thing is that it's hard to become a really good physician without glomming onto it, So there's a certain amount of glomming that's going to have to happen, but the glomming will cause the suffering down the line. Yeah, the less of the glomming, and as you get more mature about this, and part of it comes with the fact that you actually have become a good physician, so you don't have to, And it's the same with the path, and when you're first getting good at concentration, boy, do you latch onto that. But as you get more mature about it, it becomes less of a part of your, at least consciously less part of your identity. Okay, when you suddenly can't do it, that's when you realize, okay, how much deeper stuff that you thought that you would let go of has not really been let go. In my case, my father, after he retired, he really devoted all of his time to being a good carpenter. He had a big shop down in the basement, and that's where he just loved to go, down in the basement. And then he developed Parkinson's, and he couldn't be around the equipment. And one of his first accidents was grabbing hold of a router and losing a couple ends of his fingers. And then his inability to go down and do that work, I began to see how really, really attached he was, because that was so much of his identity. So this is why we have to watch out for it. While the really safe levels of becoming really are the ones that are closer to the path. And even becoming a good doctor, there will become a point where it comes back and bites you. If you haven't developed more of the ability to detach. Yes?
Just remind me, before the end of the discussions, I'll bring out what you said in the last couple of years. put it in one little cardboard.
Okay. Go ahead.
What I see is there's a balance here between expectation and acceptance.
Mm-hmm.
That the problem of what is something.
That balance is something that's going to take a while to adjust. Because as you're starting out on a new activity, there's going to be pretty high expectations. And sometimes you need the really high expectations to get you over a lot of the lumps or bumps on the way. And then as you get more skillful about it, then, okay, you don't need to have the expectations quite so high, and you begin to make them more realistic. It's a process of trial and error that enables us to do this. Again, it having a goal requires a lot of maturity. And a lot of times we start out with our goals when we're immature. And we have to learn through trial and error. But sometimes just to give yourself the motivation to do something that looks like at the beginning is going to take a huge amount of effort, you want to have some high expectations to sort of get you going. And then the acceptance would have to be both focused on, okay, this is where I want to be, this is where I actually am. What's the next step? And then instead of focusing all the way up there all the time, you say, okay, what is the next step? If I take the step one by one by one, I'll get there. In the case of a 17-year-old, I would say how to keep your aim high, but at the same time realize that to get there, you have to take this next step. And then say, okay, focus on where you are and work on the next step, the next step, the next step. But have that strong sense of motivation. Okay, I really want to do this well. There was a American philosopher named William James who one time made a distinction between two kinds of truth, basically the truth of the observer, and there's the truth of the will. And truths of the observer, you've got to get your will out of there so that you can actually observe what's happening. And for this is by scientific experiments. You say, if we want to find out what Pluto is, we can't have all our wishes about what Pluto is going to be. We actually have to set something up there and look what's up there, and then we can talk about the facts. And the way Pluto is has nothing to do with whether you want it to be that way or not. Now, the other one that we call the truth of the will, these are the things that will happen only if you will them strongly enough. Like wanting to be a great artist, or wanting to be a great doctor, or wanting to be a great whatever. Just sitting around observing the facts is not going to get you there. And sometimes the outside facts of the case might look pretty discouraging. In which case you say, okay, you have to decide on the one hand, what are your potentials, and let's see which of these potentials we can develop as far as possible. And there has to be a fair amount of will that goes into that. Now, the will has to be based, be tempered to what extent, by, okay, I tried this and it didn't work, let's back up, try something else. So, for someone who's getting started, I say, keep your goals high, but also learn how to, if you really want to get there, what are the steps? Oh, no. They have to have that will. Yeah, they have to have the aspiration. Mm-hmm. And look at the Buddha himself. He didn't say, well, gee, I guess I'll just kind of sit around and wait for awakening to happen, you know. He went out and he did all kinds of things that were really difficult, made a fair number of mistakes, but was willing to learn from them. And so if what the lesson I would give to everybody, young or old, is, okay, this is how you learn from a mistake, so you can move on. That's a skill that everybody needs. And don't let the mistakes get you down. Yes. Okay, well, do you have a specific question about them? Hell. Okay, the reason he says some beings is that there's, as we'll get to one of the later readings, he says sometimes the results don't come even in the next lifetime, they'll come lifetimes later. Okay. And there are other beings who in the meantime gain awakening, which means they don't have to go there. You know, this idea that the Buddhist teachings on karma are perfectly fair, or an attempt to impose fairness on things, is not necessarily all that fair. Someone gains awakening, they get off a lot of stuff. Now, the actual realms, those correspond both to psychological realms in the present moment and actual realms that you would go to after you die. Yeah. Mm-hmm. In addition to hell, they have the realm of the hungry ghosts and the realm of animals and the realm of the angry demons. Do you want to know details? Because that they do have a bearing on your happiness. That basically you have to take this into consideration. You know, I do something unskillful, you know, maybe I think I can get away with it, maybe I won't get away with it, you know. You know, we have a politician in America, you've probably heard of him, Dick Cheney. And he seems to be getting away with all kinds of stuff, you know. And if somebody looked at it from the outside and said, well, you know, if you really want to do evil, you've got to do a lot of evil in order to, you know, then there'll be an organization that makes sure that you lose your heart, well, they give you another heart, that kind of thing. But the Buddha's saying that's not the full, you have to take more into calculating your actions than just what's visible on this realm. This is why he talks about the other realms. You look kind of taken aback.
I had a surprising reaction reading this. When I read about hell in the Western tradition, I don't take it seriously.
Mm-hmm.
When I read this, I could feel my body shift.
Mm-hmm.
I took it seriously.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just telling you that. I have no idea what the question is.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, Buddhist hells are not eternal. And as the Buddha said, I mean, he actually checked this stuff out for himself. The times when he's describing hell, he says, I'm telling you, not because I've heard of this, I've actually seen it. The most frustrating hell is one where you're in this box, it's a flame coming out from all sides, and every now and then this door opens in one side and all the hell beings go running for the door, and just as they get there, bam, it stops, it shuts. then another door opens on another side, and they go running through the flames to get to the other door. This keeps up for a while, and finally, one of the doors, they get to the door, and it doesn't shut, and they run into it, and they fall into the hell of excrement. You know. If you were going to design a hell, that would be a pretty clever one to design. Let's move on to passage 4. Here the Buddha talks about what kind of actions are skillful and which ones are unskillful. And so unskillful bodily action comes down to taking life, taking what is not given, and engaging in sensual misconduct. Okay. The longest description there, of course, is sensual misconduct. You get sexually involved with those who are protected by their mothers, their fathers, their brothers, their sisters, their relatives. Okay, in other words, you're talking about minors. Those who are protected by their dhamma, people who have made a vow of celibacy. Those with husbands or wives. Those who entail punishments, in other words, back in the old days, if anyone was found messing around with the king's concubines, off with the head. Even those crowned with flowers by another man. In other words, they're not married, but they're going steady. You don't move in on them. Okay. Verbal misconduct comes down to telling lies, engaging in divisive speech. Sometimes this is translated as slander, and that's not what it is. Divisive speech is basically trying to break people apart. You're talking about, oh, this person over there. And sometimes you're telling true things, but you're telling with the purpose of breaking people apart. Abusive speech and idle chatter. Now, you notice, if you've ever taken the 5 precepts, that only one of these is included in the precept, and that's the one on lying. And lying is basically misrepresenting the truth consciously. Now, it does not mean you have to tell the whole truth, but what you say has to be true. You have Jews up in the attic, and you have Nazis at the door, and the Nazis say, "Do you have any Jews in the attic?" And you say, "I'm hiding nothing shameful in the attic." You've said the truth. Okay. The reason the other 3 are not included in the precept is that there are exceptions. And when you look at the monks' rules dealing with abusive speech and divisive speech, there are times when it's actually permissible. In other words, you can say something harsh to someone because they're not listening otherwise. If you have a dharma lesson you want to give, and the same thing with divisive speech, if you see somebody who is misbehaving, you go and talk to their teacher. Hey, look, so-and-so has been speaking in this way. Somebody's got to do something about this. Now, technically, that might kind of as divisive speech, but it's the situation where it's okay to do it. Or if you see this, if someone is going with somebody else, that they're afraid that they're going to be harmed, it's okay to warn them. Idle chatter, there is no precept because, as you notice, the boundaries around idle chatter are very vague. And there is a certain amount of idle chatter, which I call social grease, the things you say just to keep the group going. But as with any grease, you have to make sure you don't put too much grease in the machine. Finally, in terms of unskillful mental conduct, there are 3 things that the Buddha focuses on. One is being covetous. You want what other people have. You have ill will. May these beings be killed or cut apart or crushed or destroyed, or may they not exist at all. Or you have wrong view, saying there is nothing given, nothing offered, nothing sacrificed, no fruit or result of good or bad actions, no this world or next world, no father, no mother, no spontaneously born beings, no accomplices or Brahmins who, faring rightly and practicing rightly, proclaim this world and the next after having directly known it and realized it for themselves. I'll get back to that when we talk about the skillful counterpart of that, because it requires a fair amount of explanation, and it's 11 o'clock. So we'll stop there and meet again here at 1.